Now we come to the lecture of the 6th of October, 1904. Rudolf Steiner starts. He says, 8 days ago, I attempted to show you what modern man can find within theosophy. However, before I continue the cycle, I have to consider the special question of theosophy and its relationship to the great cultural tasks of the present time, to the significant spiritual streams of our time. And so today I want to handle the very important question, if theosophy is unscientific. That's that particular reproach which the theosophical movement meets most heavily in our age, in which science is the greatest authority. Perhaps it's the only real authority. In such a time, this misunderstanding is very significant, and so it must be close to our theosophists when we, from the sides of the science, particularly from those people who want to create a world and life configuration on the basis of a real science, from them again and again the reproach is made that theosophy is unscientific. The fact that the majority of people today seek the authority of this science, we can deduce this from a phenomena which can be very symptomatic for the interests of our period. Precisely, to be sure, the question which I now will present will be spoken in the lecture about science. Nevertheless, today I'd like to point to the great stir which was made by Haeckel's book, The Riddle of the World, in order to show that precisely the teaching of this book, which has been recognized, has produced a great interest. This book wants to build up a whole world picture on the basis of natural science. About 10,000 copies have been sold. Then a cheaper edition was made for a market which would take over 100,000 people, purchasers. Almost in this book has been translated in most of the significant languages. This appears to be less significant than that which I now want to say. Haeckel has received more than 5,000 letters which are connected with natural scientific questions. These letters contain almost all of them approximately the same questions. And so we see that with that there was impacted a very significant central requirement. A completion to the book The Riddle of the World is the book The Miracle of Life. In the introduction to that, Haeckel tells us what I have just said. In this book, you can read the reproach which is made against theosophy, that this theosophy is unscientific. And so we can see we're dealing here with a burning question. Hence, we must be clear about the fact how the whole relationship of our theosophical spiritual movement is to science itself. The person who surveys the last centuries can, in the main, not be clear about that. You must go further back. One must go back to the origin of human knowledge in a time preceding our present time reckoning. We must go back to the dawn of human knowledge, or at least to the dawn of that which today we designate as human knowledge. In order to understand completely how powerful the contrast is between the way of grasping of scientific problems today and the way scientific problems were grasped in the dawn of human knowledge, to understand the difference, we must make clear to ourselves that present science itself is completely incapable of answering the great questions of existence. In the foreword to the book The Miracle of Life, we find repeated what Haeckel often has said. He presents a standpoint of science as over against the Middle Ages period of revelation and superstition. Between truth and superstition, there is no mediation. It's either yes or no. It's an either-or proposition. And with that, he maintains that that which has been acquired on the basis of his natural scientific studies, that represents the single truth, and that everything which has been produced through other millennia are error, superstition, and unscientific. Already for the reason because the researchers of earlier centuries knew nothing of the great discoveries of the 19th century. However, the natural science of our period shows itself incapable of answering certain definite questions. Certainly, how I already in the previous lecture pointed out to you, this natural science attempts to lead us back into long past times. It attempts to go back to pre-worldly animals and plants and leads us back to that point of time where probably their first life upon earth germinated up. However, the questions, these important central questions which Dubois-Raymond presented and whose answering was attempted by Haeckel in the book, his book The Riddle of the World, the questions about the origin of life cannot find any answer in natural science. Naturally, the present-day natural scientist attempts to give an answer to these questions. Particularly Haeckel tries to give an answer to these questions. He shows how the earth has emanated out of a fiery liquid condition, gradually cooled itself off, became solid, how then water formed itself and gathered itself, and how ultimately the conditions were present which enabled living beings to arise. He attempted to show how man could imagine how out of non-living a living could sprout forth. He held the view, as opposed to the ancient convictions, he held the view that life once sprouted forth out of the non-living, and that everything which depends upon life, even the human being, is nothing other than a product of inorganic materiality. This has its rest, it depends on nothing other than that which we have in physics and chemistry. However, Haeckel tries in vain to show that man is nothing other than the result of the wonderful dynamic and mechanics of the human organism. Because there now comes the great question. There, the natural scientist arrives at the point of time where the conditions were supposed to be present upon the earth, out of which the first living beings would proceed out of the non-living material. And there one discovers by investigators, even by Haeckel, an admission that we cannot make absolutely any idea of the condition in which the earth at that time was when life first appeared upon it. We do not know how the external nature was constituted at that time, and hence it's impossible for us to say how at that time the non-living transformed itself into the living. This is one group of investigators, and they had many people who supported them in the first third of the 19th century, as they also have today. If, for example, if one asked the English scientist Darwin that about what his opinion about the how one can understand life proceeding out of materiality, if you asked his opinion, so he himself would admitted that it is impossible to understand how living life can be grasped out of the non-living. Huxley had, through his study of comparative anatomy, in the last period of his life, himself expressed the proposition that indeed we are present in an evolution in the world, and therefore why should we not conceive of the fact that that which we see around us cannot develop itself higher, that we should not conceive that the kingdom of beings has been closed once and for all, since we can look up from the lower beings to the higher beings, perhaps which are not accessible to us. There may be higher beings which for whom we have no sense organs. Well, such thoughts and objections were made themselves by the natural scientists who had more insight. It's very interesting that the German biologist Preyer, on the basis of his studies, which themselves rested upon Darwinism, he arrived at quite different views about life. He did not adhere to the view that life developed itself out of the dead, but he came to the result that that time when the earth developed the first type of living being, that that time the earth was not a dead being, but it was the single living being, and that at that time there was not present non-living upon our earth, that he felt that the non-living had developed itself out of the living. And so we see that the Darwinist Preyer arrived at a view which was quite different from the other natural scientist. Actually, quite the reversed view, insofar as he regarded the earth as a whole great living being. This, according to Preyer, was the situation millions of years ago. Our earth was a great living being, to be compared with a human or animal organism of today. Even man himself today possesses in himself living material and that which is apparently lifeless. Our bone system is apparently something lifeless. This bone system has separated itself out of the living aspect of our beingness as a non-living portion. So Preyer conceives for himself that the earth once upon a time was a great living being, and then this living being deposited out of itself the non-living, the dead, the stone and the masses of rock, just as the human being deposits out of himself the bone structure. Now this is a very important step which natural scientists and philosophers in recent times have done. And this step, of a necessity, must lead to a further step. It must lead to the step that not only the lifeless has developed itself out of the living, but also all physical, the living element and the non-living element themselves have emanated out of the spiritual. So must researchers, if they follow the path which has been already begun in the beginning, can come to the proposition that not only has non-living developed itself out of the living, but also the living itself has developed itself out of the spiritual. The spiritual was primarily, it separated out itself in the first place, the livingness, and then the livingness has separated out of itself the non-living, the dead. This, however, is nothing other than the fundamental basis of the theosophical world conception. The theosophical world conception distinguishes itself from the present materialistic natural scientific conception through the fact that it makes the spiritual primal, and it makes everything else as being dependent upon the spirit. The materialist makes material as matter as being the primal element and deduces everything from matter. I've already last time indicated that the teaching of the senses in the last century themselves point to the basis why today's natural scientists wants to persist in the view that we must deduce life out of the non-living. I pointed to the great proposition which was first expressed by the physiologist Johannes Müller and other significant physiologists, Helmholtz and then Lotze, brought it into the following formulation. The world would be dark and silent around us if we did not have ears and eyes capable of transforming the vibrations of the air into that which for us become colors and sound. That's what natural science itself says, that everything which we see around us is dependent upon us. If we did not have in a certain way constructed eyes and ears, then we would not be able to see and hear the world in this definite way. The physiologist can give us the reasons why the eye and the ear form themselves in a quite different way. That emanates from the fact that we, in our sense organs, ourselves participate in the physical world. The theosophy shows us now the fundamental concepts of which I will speak in 8 days. We see a thing through the fact that we bring the eye in the correct relationship to the things that we want to see. We understand a thing because we have intellect and can apply the intellect to configure the pictures of objects into a world structure, a world picture. And because of that, we are in a position of creating for ourselves a world picture. The theosophist expresses it like this. Man is conscious and aware of the physical world because he has senses for the physical world. Now, however, we must postulate the question, does man live only within the physical world? We can, in a preliminary way, make clear the way we're asking this question. if we conceive for ourselves a person who had no ears. He would not be able to hear the sounds of his fellow human beings. They would produce sounds and words, but without him having an ear, he would not perceive the sounding revelations of the external physical world. You must have ears in order to be conscious of the physical world. But now we have to ask the question, does man consist completely only of such physical manifestations as being able to sound words, etc.? No. You all know that within the body in which man and an animal is enclosed, there are present not only physical activities, but also there are present in the human being feelings, drives, passions, desires, and wishes. These desires, wishes, drives, and passions are just as likewise realities as the physical functions. Just as you digest your food and just as you speak, so also do you feel, do you wish, do you have desires. The digestion and the speaking are physical manifestations, and we can perceive them with physical senses for our physical consciousness. Why is it that we cannot perceive the other reality, which is also present in us, namely our wishes, our desires, the soul moods and the passions? Why can't we likewise perceive them? And so we speak quite in the sense of natural science when we say that we cannot perceive them because we do not possess any sense organs for them. Now, however, the world conception at the basis of the theosophical movement shows us that man can become conscious not only of a physical world, but also of a higher world. And when we regard and perceive, and when we see the manifestations of this higher world, then to us, wishes, desires, passions, and drives are likewise just as perceptible realities as it is possible for physical capacity of perception to have the speech as being a physical activity, a physical expression of a physical activity. When you say then that consciousness has then been awakened for the so-called astral world, then man stands before us as a being of drives, wishes, and passions, just as he stands before us as a physical being who reflects back the impressions of light and so is visible for us. How we can awaken these higher senses, how man can acquire the higher consciousness, that we will hear about in the lecture cycle entitled The Fundamental Concepts of Theosophy. Man lives in this higher world, but his consciousness, insofar as he is an average man of the present time, his consciousness has not been awakened for this higher world. Now, there exists a third world, a world of thinking, a world of higher spiritual life, a world which is above that of the world of passions, desires, wishes, and drives. This world of thoughts, the world of spirituality, is still less accessible to physical consciousness. Now, this world of pure spirit should not be denied by that person who stands upon the viewpoint of modern philosophy, but he should consider the fact that perhaps the reason why we do not experience this spiritual world is that we do not possess the organs capable of perceiving them. Man lives also in this third world. He thinks in this third world. It just happens he cannot perceive this third world. And so we can say that man lives today in three worlds. These worlds we designate in the German language as the physical world, the physische Welt, die seelische Welt, and die geistige Welt. The physical world, the soul world, and the spiritual world. In the accustomed theosophical way of expressing it, they are called the physical world, the astral world, and the mental world. Man, however, is conscious only in the first world, the physical world, and hence, scientifically, he can only tackle the physical world. About the other worlds, he can tackle only when they are just as visible to him, just as perceptible to him, just as conscious to him as he is today in the physical world. So we have in the human being in front of us a threefold living being that forms a totality out of the physical, soul, and the spirit, but he is conscious only in the physical. Hence, that researcher who can perceive only within the physical world, only to him, his investigation glance is open the physical world. Even to the investigating glance of that person who is equipped with all the most modern means of science, to him also there is offered no other world other than that which is offered by the ordinary sense life. If he even is able to look back millions of years to the evolution of the earth, so he sees back to the point where gradually the physical condensed itself out of the dawning of the astral world. This astral world, which is much more illuminated than a physical light. The physical has condensed itself, proceeded out of the astral world. And still earlier, the astral world has proceeded out of the spiritual world. That place where the spirit gradually condensed itself to the living material, and later condensed itself to the non-living material, to that point, only that eye which is become opened can see. Hence the physical researcher, through his methods of investigation, is restricted to the point where the physical manifests itself, aufblitzt, lights up, aufblitzt up, where the physical lights itself up as it's formed itself out of the soul spiritual. That's the only place where this physical researcher can start off with. So we arrive at the fact that the physiologists lift himself up to the periphery, to that point where the living becomes spiritual. However, the spiritual researcher can lift himself up into still an earlier past, and with that the spiritual researcher can create for himself a much more comprehensive world picture, a world picture that far supersedes the world picture made by the physical researcher. With all this, we have demonstrated that the theosophical world conception should not therefore be categorized as unscientific, just because it produces a different world picture from physical research. Of course, at the basis of the theosophical world conception, there are other experiences, namely the ability to awaken oneself upon the spiritual plane. Just as you are in a room which is dark, and you try to, by means of touch, try to find yourself away in your room, how then a quite different impression arises when a light is made in this dark room, so there appears for that spiritual researcher for whom his eyes have been opened, everything appears in a new activity, in a different light. This researcher has not become unscientific just because he has enriched his experiences. The logic of a theosophist can be just as secure and solid as the logic of the best natural scientist. And it just happens that this logic applies itself in a different domain. The same way upon a higher plane, on about higher planes, as a physical researcher thinks on physical planes. And you can say there is a harmonization in the way of thinking of the theosophical method of investigation and the physical method of investigation. However, now we can have an explanation of the fact why the modern researcher expresses this either-or and rejects everything which is of not a physical nature. It is clear to the theosophical researcher why it must be, because this is connected with the whole development and evolution of mankind. Because the theosophist is able to contemplate the development of mankind in a much higher light, and because he can follow the preparation upon the spiritual domain, because of that, the theosophist is in a position to recognize out of the necessities of development and evolution why the physical intellectual science ascribes to itself the sole authority. What man calls today science was not always there. Just as every plant, every animal has evolved, just as the races of man have developed themselves and evolved, likewise is there an evolution connected with the spiritual life. And even the science of today was not always in the same stage. Even this science is a product of evolution. However, in the most ancient periods, there did exist a kind of way of human perception, even if it is not scientific in the modern sense. Hence, one must go back into the period in which you have the beginning of our human life. Everything is in evolution. The human race, millions of years ago, was much different from that which one conceives of ourselves today. Also, this differentiation will be spoken about in my lectures entitled The Fundamental Concepts of Theosophy. Now, the human race of today was preceded by another race, the Atlantean race. Even Plato reports about it. Now, this race is not something that can be denied by natural science. This race thought differently, lived differently, and developed different forces from those possessed by present-day mankind. The person who wants to learn more about that can read about it in my magazine, Lucifer. After the decay and the destruction of this human race, this root race, there develops itself, there began to develop itself another race which began to have the sort of thinking and perception which belongs to us today. And also within our present root race, we distinguish again seven sub-races, of which our own race is the fifth sub-race. Mankind developed itself very gradually, and so very gradually did the spiritual life of mankind develop itself. If we go back to the spiritual life of the first sub-races of our root race, then the spiritual life shows itself quite different from our present spiritual life. The thinking of these people was quite different. It was such a thinking that cannot really be compared with our present combining intellectual knowledge. This thinking was more of a spiritual thinking. It was such that was produced through a kind of spiritual instinct, a kind of intuition. Even that's not the correct way of describing it. It is much more a spiritual kind of thinking. This spiritual kind of thinking possessed in itself, as in a germinal condition, all the other human spiritual activities. What today manifests itself separately as fantasy, as religious piety, as ethical feeling, and at the same time as scientificness, all that at that time was all one. Just as the whole plant is enclosed in the seed, in a unity, so that which today expresses itself in many spiritual activities, that was also that time, all those were enclosed in a unity. The fantasy was not that fantasy which today we ascribe as something unreal. That fantasy was fructified by the spiritual content of the world, so that that fantasy brought forth truth and reality. It was not that which we designate today as the artistic fantasy. It was that which at the same time in its images contained the truth. The feeling aspect and the ethical will aspect were inwardly united with this fantasy. The whole of man was a unity. He was a spiritual cell. We are able externally to get an idea of that when we test for ourselves that which still remains with us. If you, for example, study the ancient spiritual products, as for example you study the Vedas of ancient India, there you find art, poetry and spirit as if they're flowing out of one spring, one fountain. Truth, poetry and the feeling for duty at that time flowed out of a single center of the human being, out of a common intuition. We can also study the concepts which have remained behind out of the ancient time of the Druids, and which lie at the basis of our ideas. And we will find that the temple buildings, the way the Druids arranged their stones, are copies of cosmic world measures. All that demonstrates to us an earlier evolution. Now, then we come up to the next sub-race. There we see how the spiritual activities separate themselves, just as in the beginning the branches of a tree spread themselves out. We see how later on in the Chaldean Egyptian period the science of astronomy separates itself from the purely practical science, as piece by piece it separates itself from that which was a unified perception, and you get subsidiary separated strivings. And so we can follow a quite definite law in our fifth root race, that particularly the human being of this fifth root race gradually has conquered the physical world in all its domains. If we contemplate what we've just described as a spiritual man at the beginning of our age, so we see that in him, with him, everything was spirit. The ancient Vedic priests did not yet know the desire, the hanging towards the physical. The physical to the ancient Vedic priest was something unworthy. His glance was directed only to the eternal course of events. His glance was directed up to heaven. The earthly things scarcely touched him. In our time, this Vedic perception, the perception of the Vedas, appears to be an anachronism. We see how this perception of the physical is no more appropriate to our age, and how precisely the Indian folk suffers under that perception, because its inner glance has become darkened back. Its inner glance has been retreated from a world which cannot understand any longer this particular glance. Man must conquer with his spiritual glance, he must conquer the physical world. The man is immersed in the physical world, and he must continually work over the physical world. First, the glance was directed into one's inner self. Then, with the Chaldeans and the Egyptians, the glance was directed up to the stars. And if we proceed forward to the Greeks, then we see that that which with them was earlier united, namely philosophy, religion, and art, which were all united, gradually we see they separated into three quite separate spiritual activities. In the ancient Veda, the priest is at the same time poet, scientist, and religious prophet. If we proceed forward towards Greekdom, so we see the philosopher, the artist, and the priest separate themselves. And what has occurred according to the law of evolution in ancient Greece? The physical world was in the first place conquered through one of the spiritual activities. The physical world was in the first place conquered through fantasy. The conquering of the physical world by means of fantasy, this is represented by the powerful Greek art. If we go further into the first Christian period, we can discover that this had prepared itself already in the Ancient Testament, within antiquity. However, the new domain was conquered by the spirituality of the Christian period. It is the domain of the ethical, the moral life. If you go back into ancient Greece, so you see that the moral aspect doesn't appear separated from the general world conception. It's only with Socrates and Plato that you have the beginning of the ethical ethical and moral aspect separating itself. Christianity conquers the ethical moral world. Just as the ancient Greece conquered the physical world in art through fantasy, so Christianity conquered the physical, ethical life upon the earth in a spiritual way. The Greek conquered the ethical world through art and fantasy. Christianity conquered it through a spiritual activity. This is a second phase of evolution. And again, if we go back to a time round about the turning of the 15th and 16th century, you will see how that which earlier on was united once again splits itself up again. We see how the world conception man, the philosopher, separates himself from the scientist. Previously, there was no separation between the philosopher and the natural scientist. If you look back into the first periods of the Middle Ages, just contemplate Scotus Erigena, Albertus Magnus. All those who have taken in hand the spiritual life, you will see that all that goes hand in hand between the spiritual philosophical researchers and the purely physical research. There was no separation. Even with Cartesius and Spinoza, you can find the echoes of a union of philosophy and science. Philosophical thinking earlier on went hand in hand with natural science. However, with the 15th and 16th century, you get a division. Science separates itself from philosophy. Science becomes independent. A new domain of physical life is conquered. The domain which is conquered through physics, astronomy, a domain conquered through a purely physical intellectual science. And so we see that which early on was united, science, art, philosophy, religion, ethics, these which were early on united, they continue to travel along separated paths. Again, later on, attempts were made to bring again to a unity that which earlier was a unity. We see this striving even with Goethe. We see how he has tried to create a spiritual natural science and to find a bridge between science and art. A sentence from him shows that when he says that the beautiful is a manifestation of hidden nature laws, which without its appearance would remain forever hidden. Furthermore, Richard Wagner had attempted to unite the mythos of the religion into a new art form, which was supposed to be much more than an art built up on pure fantasy. These strivings remind us of something which was present all times. Besides the separated ways which were preceded by religion, art, science, and ethics, there always existed that which one designated as the great unity. Besides, by the side of science, art, and philosophy, there existed the whole of the mysteries. The whole world picture was presented to the initiates of the mysteries. There it was not told him in a scientific way what once was there. There he was not told in a scientific way about the laws of the cosmos. What was happened there, he was actually there in the mysteries, was created a replica of life. In the drama of Dionysus, there was revealed to him how man, the spirit man, immersed himself in physical matter, how the spiritual condensed itself in matter in order later on in the future to lift itself up again to the spirit. In grandiose pictures, this artistic work, this Dionysus drama, was presented in the ancient Greek mysteries. It was shown how Dionysus is the son of Zeus and Semele, how he is saved through Pallas Athene, and how his heart is saved from Zeus. Here we have the presentation of a great human drama. It is supposed to represent nothing other than life within our earth. It is supposed to be shown how man is immersed in the physical form, how his soul was saved through that deepest spirit within his inner being, how he himself can again develop himself up to a new divine existence. Now, externally in Greek culture, then there appeared separated that which was presented in the depths of the mystery temple as a unity. That which is related by Socrates and that which is presented by philosophy, but by Plato in philosophy, that is nothing other than an external replica, a splitting off of that which was found it would exist in the mysteries, an Abspaltung, separation of that which could be found in the mysteries. If you read Plato, you will see a philosophical representation of the mystery drama. Read the tragic destiny of the heroes. So you have in these hero dramas a weak reflection of the mystery drama. The philosophy developed itself out of the ancient art. In our modern age, the last separation occurred. The intellectual science separated itself, that intellectual science which limited itself to the physical world and has conquered the world. The microscope and the telescope have conquered the world. Just as Christian art had conquered the inner world of feeling, so has physical science conquered external nature. That is the task. That was the great world mission, namely, that which earlier was a unity was and then became separated into its single parts, that has to be reconquered. To establish the paths leading to unity of all four, a unity of science, philosophy, ethics and art, that's the mission of our coming age. And theosophy wants to prepare the mission for a new mankind. Hence, the first significant work which theosophy produced, The Secret Doctrine, written by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, appears with a subtitle, Unity of Science, Religion and Philosophy. And that's how the theosophical world conception relates itself to the single branches which fill up today the spiritual life. And so we see why you can't comfort yourself when the world conception of natural science calls out for an either-or. You see why theosophy focuses its whole glance in order to effect a reconciliation. That's the ideal of theosophy. Because mankind represents itself as a totality in every single human being, hence this ideal, this is the great human ideal of our age. Man had to reach its goal on separated paths within our root race. But these paths separate themselves only for a certain period, according to the great cosmic law. Then the separated paths must again unite themselves. And now is the time for this uniting. In every single human being, the truth must develop itself. And the person who expresses his knowledge expresses it only in the sense that he wants to perhaps stimulate that in the other person. The theosophical teacher is very, very well known that the truth must be brought out of each individual himself. And because of that, we have the other aspect of the theosophical world conception, namely the fundamental proposition of tolerance. So we don't unite ourselves to a single truth, to a single dogma. No person has to recognize anything, but we are searchers towards the truth. We have to manifest the most tolerant soul mood, tolerance right into our feelings and into our thoughts. The Theosophist realizes that in every human being, in his own breast there rests the truth, the kernel of truth. But all man needs is to be surrounded by a spiritual atmosphere in order to permit this kernel of truth to develop itself. Everywhere where Theosophists unite themselves, they create around themselves that atmosphere in which every single human germ can foster itself. And it's in this working together that Theosophy sees its actual task. Other people could consider themselves monists, and they consider dualism as false. But we know that dualism is true, monism is true, but they can unite themselves into a unity in a still higher harmony, as long as you seek for further spiritual development. All the great spirits of the past express this, also Goethe. And he said that man in himself must give birth to divine truth, that this divine truth must spring forth out of the single human heart. And so, as the motto of our theosophical movement, we can have what Goethe put at the peak of his scientific work. And this is the motto: if the wäre nicht das Auge sonnenhaft, wie könnten wir das Licht erblicken? Lebt nicht in uns des Gottes eigene Kraft, wie konnt uns göttliches entzücken? If the eye itself was not of a sun nature, how would it be possible for us otherwise than to look at the light? If God's own force did not live in us, how would it be possible otherwise for us to be charmed towards the divine? And here ends the lecture. A very clear lecture, a very good lecture, a preliminary lecture, an important lecture.